this hour of the Jason Rand Show brought to you by Primary Residential Mortgage, PRMIseattle.com. Lots of news happening all around the world and right here at home. So let's find out what's trending.
What's trending in Seattle?
They call him the lawnmower man.
You cannot come out here and arrest people.
That guy's name is Charles Woodward. He is a homeless man living in Ballard. And he goes by the nickname Lawnmower Man. It's almost like a really lame superhero name. He is not a superhero. He's super annoying, but he is not a superhero. This is a man who is in what Como TV is calling a tense standoff with the neighborhood. Because he has decided that he's going to take up space that he's not paying for, that he does not own, treating it as his own, lining up nearly two dozen lawnmowers at the corner of 8th Avenue and 49th Street, which is not very far away from the homeless music studio. Now, it's very difficult to walk on the sidewalk with all of the nearly two dozen lawnmowers and the subsequent trash that this man has collected. It's trash. It's his trash, but it's trash. He's parked three cars and two wooden sheds at this part of Seattle as well. Making it worse, he's been known to blast some music from time to time, and from time to time I mean a lot. Maybe he knows the homeless recording studio proprietor. According to Como TV, they say he produces a loud mechanical grating noise as well for some reason. And any time he is asked to turn down the music or tone down some of the noise, he just goes ahead and yells at them. He cusses at them. He gets in their face.
I'm allowed to make noise at night just like they are.
He's allowed to make noise at night just like they are. Of course, when they make noise, it's usually indoors and it's surrounded by some sort of mitigated effect. So it's not, you know, blasting an entire neighborhood. And something tells me that if someone knocks on one of the neighbor's doors and said, excuse me, it's getting kind of late. I would really appreciate it if you could maybe turn the music down. You're not turn off, just turn it down just a little bit. I'm sure they'd probably say, oh, okay, I'm so sorry. I didn't realize it was getting that loud. My bad. I really apologize. But you see, that's because they have some regard for the city. They actually care about their neighborhood and their neighbors. Charles Woodward does not. The lawnmower does not. The lawnmower man does not. And neighbors are pretty ticked off. Here's Kelly speaking with Como.
Doesn't seem to care. In fact, has threatened my neighbors.
Threatened the neighbors. He's not someone who cares. He's not someone who likely will ever care. Now, Sean lives nearby. He's been doing his level best as a resident to try to get some sort of resolution here. Sure, he knows we live in the city of Seattle where the city doesn't necessarily care. Sure, we know that he has a council member in Dan Strauss who definitely doesn't care. But he tried anyway, saying he's reached out to every single city agency he could think of for help, and yet no one's willing.
We're kind of stuck right now in this situation. The Hope team said there's nothing they can do if Charles doesn't want services. They can't force him to take it.
You see, he's been offered services. He's been offered housing. He's specifically been offered a place to go. And he has simply said no.
What kind of housing? What, with other crazy people? What are you, stupid?
That's his reasoning. And even though he's saying no, the city then says, okay. Because in the city of Seattle, there are no consequences of this kind of behavior. Not when you live in a community that Dan Strauss is representing. Not when you have a mayor who still isn't willing to do what needs to be done in cases like this. If he doesn't want to leave and he's been offered housing, he's been treated in good faith, and he chooses not to leave, that's when you move him, throw away the trash, and it's trash. And if he refuses to abide by the law, if he's breaking any specifically, you arrest. End of story. Go ahead and tow those vehicles. Tow them. This is a neighborhood that belongs for all, not for one selfish person who doesn't care about anybody else but himself. And arguably, he doesn't care for himself either. He seems like he's got something potentially mentally wrong. Don't know. He could just be an angry person. But he doesn't care. He doesn't care about consequences. He doesn't care about the people around him. And so he's going to continue to do this over and over and over again some more because there are no consequences. And even the threat of potentially towing his vehicle, he doesn't care.
I'm not concerned about getting towed. Ain't nobody going to touch my
No one is going to touch his stuff. He's smart enough to understand that in the city of Seattle, no one is going to touch any of his stuff. They don't care. They're not going to get in the way. They're not going to take away his property because he's chosen to stay in Seattle because he knows that he's going to be able to do whatever it is he wants. And despite the fact that Sean has been trying to get a hold of the mayor, no such luck.
Do nothing, Durkin doesn't answer her phone. She doesn't respond.
Of course not. Of course not. And obviously, this has an impact for living in the city.
The selective enforcement of our rules around here is really wearing down the compassion that we have for this issue.
That's kind of the Seattle way. You sort of take advantage of people's compassion, and then you take advantage some more. And just when you think you can't get away with anything else, you push it just one more time. And sometimes the city course corrects. We had an election just now that attempted the course correction. Obviously, there's a long way to go, but we had some really good results. People are sick and tired of this garbage. Some of the literal garbage that's on the street, courtesy of people like this, and the garbage policies or lack thereof. You can get away with almost anything, whether you're homeless or whether you are someone who is a criminal. Going into a Target and stealing a whole bunch of stuff, knowing that you're not going to get popped, knowing you're not going to see any jail time. In this case, this guy knows he's not going to get towed. They are flaunting in front of everybody. They are flaunting an unwillingness to get the help that we are offering, and thus they are not worthy of our compassion. This is a man who is not worthy of our compassion. Not if he is knowingly saying no to the housing options. The caveat, of course, being if he's dealing with some sort of mental illness, okay. Guess what we should be doing? Treating the mental illness, not allowing him to fall deeper and deeper into that abyss. Not allow him to continue to go down that pathway that you're not going to be able to turn back. You're not going to be able to turn back. Not this guy. Not if you keep letting him out. Now, when you keep letting him get away with this kind of thing without any consequences whatsoever. Now, these neighbors are considering their next steps. And so they're saying, hey, maybe we need to file a restraining order against this guy. Because he's very clearly getting more and more aggressive. And Jonathan Cho did this story. If you go to his Twitter feed, he's got the extended version of this conversation. And it's really not a conversation. It's just this guy yelling like a crazy person. But he knows he doesn't have to move. And he's taking advantage of that. And we're all the suckers for dealing with it. You know why there's selective enforcement, just to answer Sean's question, is because the people who pay taxes, the people who are paying the taxes that go into all these services that don't actually do anything, we're saps. We're saps. We're getting taken advantage of, and we keep saying, okay, we're going to keep complying. And obviously, I'm not telling people not to pay their taxes, but you get taken advantage of. And that's what's happening here. We are being taken advantage of. And it's not going to stop until you get a full, and I mean a full, remake of this council. We're starting the step. We got the baby steps in place. We're taking them. We hit our first goal, making sure the police abolitionists don't get power. Making sure that the next mayor at least talks about wanting to address this issue. But that is step, what, two? Of a 10-tier process, but baby steps. We'll get there. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to send me the text. Find out what else is trending.
What's trending? The coronavirus.
We're, what, 2 weeks now into the COVID vaccine being available for children 5 and up. I saw this stat last night that in Seattle, and I believe it was Seattle, King County, 15% of the kids eligible have already received their first, their shot, their only shot. And obviously, that is a very high percentage for such a short amount of time. Now, how much longer that lasts, meaning is it going to continue at that pace? I don't know. But obviously, this means that in this area, the resistance, as far as we can tell, is not what it is nationwide. There's this new study from the Kaiser Family Foundation out, and they are providing more insights into whether or not parents will be getting their kids vaccinated. Now, the last time they took this poll, it was right before the vaccine rollout had actually begun, and it showed some 70% or so saying they're at least hesitant to get their kids vaccinated. And so they've been really looking at vaccine willingness from a family perspective, meaning so for kids, since last December. And they say right now parents are about evenly divided as to whether or not they're going to get their kids vaccinated. You have 27% who say, yeah, I'm going to do it the moment I can. And obviously that's reflected, for example, in that 15% of Seattleites who've decided to get their kids vaccinated. You have 33% taking a more moderate position that actually makes sense. They're going to wait and see. They don't necessarily want to rush, but they're also not saying 100% hands down, never in my life will I let this vaccination go inside of my kid. And that seems like a reasonable position for a parent to take, because I actually think for the most part, most adults held that position on the vaccine. I certainly did. I wasn't going to be the first person to get the vaccine. That doesn't seem wise to me. I'll wait and see how it goes. I waited and saw. I did some research. I talked to my doctor, which is what I recommend every single person do. And bam, that's when I made my decision. That is a normal process. You've got 30% saying definitely not. So 30% of people saying nope. And then you have 5% say they'll do it, but only if you force it. So I'm counting that as a no. So you've got 35% basically saying no. You've got another 33% saying no right now, but we'll see. So you haven't really budged much from the 70% number saying we're resistant. So nothing really has changed in the few weeks since it's become available, the couple weeks it's become available. And one of the reasons why so many people have concerns is that they don't understand what the long-term effects of this vaccine on their kids will be. And again, that is a reasonable position. I understand it. 76% say that. 71% are concerned about serious side effects from the vaccine. 66% are concerned about the future fertility for their kids when they become adults. Now, there's been no evidence that's been presented at this point on the fertility concern. There's been none. There's been conspiracy theories, sure, but there's been no actual data suggesting that there's a problem. Still, does it make sense for a parent who's looking at a kid who is otherwise healthy, who is one of the, it actually is the lead, it depends on the kid's age, but if we're talking about like that 5 to 12 zone, or really under 12, they are the least impacted by COVID unless they have a serious underlying health condition. They are the least impacted of them all. And so if you understand that, and if you're a parent, I imagine you do understand that. You've done probably more research on this for your kids than for yourself. You understand that if you already have a very, very low risk, even if you were to get COVID, of getting seriously ill or even noticing that you're ill, certainly way there's almost impossible for your kid to die from it, again, with some caveats, you're going to look at this a lot differently than you would look at yourself. So let's say you're a 47-year-old, maybe you got 20 pounds overweight, maybe you're pre-diabetic, whatever it happens to be. Of course, you look at that and say, okay, no, the data makes it very clear that I would benefit from this vaccine. But if you're looking at your 7-year-old who's absolutely healthy, and you look at the data suggesting that kids barely get hit hard by COVID as of right now, you're going to want to wait and see. I get that. I totally get that. We have these conversations. And anytime you say anything about the vaccine, unless you follow the script that folks on the left want you to follow, you get called an anti-vaxxer. There was someone who sent me an email yesterday just ripping into my story saying, I'm going to report you to the FCC because of something that was written. So the FCC is not going to take a look at that in the way you might think. But attacking me for misinformation because I said the death rate in Washington State from COVID is 1.13%. And the breakthrough case rate, breakthrough, of course, being situations where a vaccinated person has become infected with COVID was at 1.19, so it's higher. I believe those percentages were, I'm going off of memory, but one was higher. The breakthrough case rate is higher. They're still very low. But merely just presenting that data, I'm told that not only was it disinformation, but I am attacking the efficacy of the vaccine. Even though in my piece at KTTH.com, it quite literally talks about how the data suggests that the vaccine is very efficacious, that it actually does protect people from going to a hospital and from dying. I'm not anti-vax. I'm pro-vaccine. I'm pro you making up your own mind. And it's okay if you have a different position on the vaccine than I do. I got vaccinated to protect myself. I don't view you as dirty. I don't view you as a threat if you are unvaccinated. I just view you as someone who made a different choice than I did. And that's okay. We're not supposed to be judging people the way that these folks so desperately want us to. They want us to shame the unvaccinated, and I'm not going to do that because I'm against mandates. But I'm also against people who make disingenuous claims on COVID, whether it has to do with the death rate, which is incredibly low, or frankly, the vaccines, which are efficacious. They don't prevent you from getting COVID. People lied about that. They misled people. Maybe they did it with the right intentions. They just got it wrong, and maybe not. Maybe they didn't care even to look. They just wanted to get people vaccinated. Okay. You get to live with that decision, and you will be judged by history for that move. But at the end of the day, I look at this and I'm so sick and tired of people just judging folks for doing something for themselves and their family that they believe is right. That some stranger should be judging someone who doesn't want to get their kid vaccinated at this point is just pretty despicable to me. It's alarming. Because you know what? We can make the same judgment calls against a person who was first in line for a vaccine that they have no clue what was in it. They had no, especially the people who did it right at the beginning, the ones who were, you think that they did any research? They wanted the hope. I get that. I want hope all the time. I want hope that ivermectin works. I want hope that hydroxychloroquine works. Weirdly, on the left, the people who are just leaning into the vaccine, they don't want the other stuff to work because I guess Donald Trump was in support, so we have to go after that medication. It is just bizarre how hypocritical these folks are and just how callous they are. Not understanding. I'm not a parent. Don't plan to be. Don't particularly like kids. But I certainly understand the need to want to protect one from a potential danger. And for a lot of people, this is a potential danger because they are weighing the risks associated with not getting the vaccine. And those risks, very, very low for most kids. Not all. Most kids. Which is why at the end of the day, I say, you don't have to listen to me. In fact, I don't want you taking my advice on medical issues. I'm not a doctor. Neither are other talk show hosts or TV personalities or columnists. The ones who are telling you under no uncertain terms, go get that vaccine. They don't know you at all, and they are not doctors. In the end, they might be right for your family, but they don't know you. They don't know your history. They don't know your family history, the medical history. Go talk to your doctor. Have an honest conversation with them. And if you don't think you can trust your doctor, get a new doctor. If you trust them for all the other things you go to them for, I'm presuming you're going to trust them on this. If you don't, get a new doctor. You would be better served by that. But you do have to have a conversation with your doctor. That's what I would recommend. And I also recommend that people relax a little bit on just shaming people because they hold a different viewpoint than you do on vaccines. It's ridiculous. 1-800-465-877 if you want to send me a text right now.
Tacoma, Bremerton, Bothell.
This is the Big Local on the Jason Ranch Show.
Redmond, Sumner, Kent.
Stories about you, not about Seattle.
Hey, look at that. It's 4:30 on a weekday afternoon. That means it's time for the Big Local, brought to you by Alpine Specialty Cleaning at alpineclean.com. This is the part of the show where we completely ignore stories coming out of Seattle, and instead we focus all of our attention on the communities you care about, the communities you live in, the communities you want us to focus on, all at the expense of Seattle. And I say, I'm all in. And we start with kind of a heartbreaking story out of the city of Kent. There are a lot of students not just in Kent, but across the state, and really across the country, who are dealing with patently absurd, patently unbelievable policies surrounding COVID in their schooling. That they can't go in for a number of days if some classmate that you maybe didn't even have contact with ends up getting COVID, even if they are asymptomatic, even if it doesn't hurt them all that much, which is the vast majority, and I mean vast majority of COVID cases when they impact kids. And we put impact in air quotes because we know it doesn't impact kids the same way. But a lot of kids are being left behind. One group of children getting left behind are those who have different special educational needs. Ellen Carter is one of those kids. She lives in Kent. She's just 8 years old. And according to King 5, she has a well-documented medical issue that precludes her from safely attending class in person. And she's just trying to get her education. Unfortunately, it's not happening. Unfortunately, this young girl is not getting the education that she wants because the Kent School District decided to pretty much out of nowhere end her virtual access to the school that she goes to, Emerald Park Elementary. And she had very little directions on what she's supposed to do for the last 2.5 months of her schooling.
My mom said I won't miss anything, but I've missed a lot, because I don't really do school. Sometimes I make pretend math problems for myself.
Okay, so that's how bad it is. She's making pretend math problems for herself. That's how much she misses school. Now, this is someone who was diagnosed with medical conditions and learning disabilities. So under state law, under federal law, she has to receive specialized educational services and a free public education. King 5 says she's one of about 143,000 students eligible right now for special education services in the state. But for more than 10 weeks in the Kent School District, they haven't fulfilled her individualized education plan, the IEP. This is a legally binding document that explains very clearly, very specifically, what services, including extra services, Ellie would need to succeed in school. You don't just say, well, they would need this service. You provide it. You provide it. And the problem here is she was able to go to school early on. She was just doing it via Zoom.
She brought it, the computer, into class, but everyone else wasn't online. It was kind of different for me, but I met new friends.
All of that has stopped. All of a sudden, they decided, no, we're not going to do it. Andy is her dad.
To see my daughter happy, it made me feel good. It made me feel like this process is going to work. I was upset. I was in shock. I don't understand how you can just cut someone off at the knees with no conversation.
So how many other kids are being impacted like this? How many other kids are being impacted like this? Because this family is suing. Or they're about to.
Federal and state law requires a school district to provide the education that a child needs based on their disability.
That's Jeanette Cohen. She's the attorney representing the family. Does it sound like they're asking for much? No. Not at all. So tell me exactly why the education is stopped. Oh, this is kind of interesting. Tim Martin is the president of the Kent Education Association. He said it was the union, that objected to this live streaming arrangement in the classroom because the district, he says, has refused to provide her second grade teacher with additional time, resources, training, and compensation.
We've tried to bargain this repeatedly. Uh-huh. The district has refused to provide the resources necessary for this to be successful.
Are we pretending it takes that much more work and energy for this teacher to have Ellie in class on a Zoom call? Contents you're already teaching to the classroom? We're going to pretend that? that somehow that means you need additional resources, time, training, and, oh, of course, compensation. Uh-huh. But Tim Martin says, you guys just don't understand what it is we're talking about, our needs. The district doesn't understand.
Just because you have a camera in the back of the room does not make for a quality education. And it is like pounding my head against a wall to get our district to understand what teachers do, the differences between online instruction and in-person instruction.
Yeah, online instruction, even when you're putting your entire energy and effort into it, isn't particularly good. We know that, but it is something. And this is what that girl wants. This is what the girl is entitled to get. And you're choosing to say no because, let's be honest, this is just about the money. Don't buy this nonsense that's about, well, you know, doing schoolwork online or teaching online, that requires a special skill set. What more training would you need? You've been doing this for the last several months, right? You did it all last year. What training does this teacher need? This is, of course, nonsense. The lawyer, Cohen, she says she's never seen something like this before.
In all the years I've been doing this, this is the first time I've ever had the teachers union interfere with the implementation of an IEP. But I do not believe that there's any legal authority for a child's program to be held hostage by a teachers union.
Yeah, well, welcome to 2021. Where were you for 2020? No offense to this lawyer, but we knew that this was going to happen. This should come as no shock. We're told that teachers are heroes. You better respect teachers. They're doing God's work. And yet, here's a girl who just wants an education, who can't actually go to school. She just wants an education, and you're denying that to her. You're telling her no.
It made me, like, kind of sad. I wouldn't get to see my friends.
That seem fair to you? Does that seem like the right thing to do? Or do you think that maybe they're going a little bit overboard with this? That maybe they've stepped over the line just a little bit? Or are you just okay? You're content with the direction that they're... Okay. I'll pretend that that's a viable answer. If it makes you feel better. Meanwhile, we turn to King County. We've had conversations about this in the past. It's wholly ridiculous, but now... Unfortunately, voters don't get the right to vote on the next sheriff. Instead, what they end up having to do is allow King County Executive Dow Constantine to make the selection. And he says the new sheriff search to replace Mitzi Johanknik, it's currently underway. What are they looking for exactly? What do you think they're looking for? Before you answer that, hold tight. Here's Kara 7 TV's Lindsay Sheldon.
It comes just over a year after voters approved the switch back to an appointed sheriff. Constantine said that there will be an interim sheriff on January 1st when Mitzi Johanknik's term ends. The search will be a national one, he says, and he expects it to be done by next summer. Constantine will choose a candidate and the county council will vote to confirm them.
Huh. Who do you think they're going to pick? Who do you think Dale Constantine is going to pick? Someone who wants to re-envision, reimagine, but first dismantle the police department, then reimagine and re-envision, or whatever nonsense language you want to use to talk about how you're going to dismantle and then rebuild it in an image that's driven by politics. Who do you think he's going to appoint? What kind of person do you think he'll appoint? There are very far to the left law enforcement officials, because the only rule under this is the person has to actually have had a law enforcement background. But whoever he picks is going to likely be an activist, and that activist is going to be put in front of the King County Council that's run by a majority activist. In a lot of ways, they have now become the opposite version of the Seattle City Council, the city we don't talk about during this segment. I think that is a meaningful question. Who do you think they're going to put in place? It's going to be someone who's anti-cop. It's going to be someone who will now have to answer to a politician. A politician who is driven by the activists in the community, not by the regular voters. But Jason, you just won another term. Yeah, he was running against someone who was equally as far to the left as he is. He wins on name recognition. Now, the only saving grace in all of this is that he's going to run for governor. And hopefully he ends up losing, or that would be really bad for the state. But it would obviously be really good to get rid of him in King County. Let him go focus on a campaign that he hopefully won't win, while maybe we get some semblance of leadership that won't be so far to left. Unfortunately, that's not going to happen this soon enough. that it won't impact the King County Sheriff's Office. So we'll end up seeing what happens. You're listening to The Jason Rand Show, 1-800-465-8770. If you want to send me a text message right now. Welcome back to the Jason Rand Show on AM 770 KTTH and 94.5 FM on the Greater East Side. It was yet another crazy day in Kenosha with the Kyle Rittenhouse trial, where there was a dispute over the drone video that was used during the trial. In fact, it got so heated in the end, it was the defense asking for a mistrial to help explain exactly what happened today. Is someone who knows a thing or two about the courthouse. He used to be a federal prosecutor, and of course, he was also the former chief of staff to acting secretary of defense, Christopher Miller, under the Trump administration. Joining me on the line is Kash Patel. Kash, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. Excited to be here.
So first, if you could, just from the legal standpoint, explain what happened with the video.
Yeah, so look, as a former federal prosecutor and actually a former public defender who tried 60 jury trials to verdict, I'm a little familiar with this stuff, so it's been a minute. And so what juries can do is they're allowed to review any and all of the evidence that's submitted during a trial. They don't have to sit in jury room and review it. If there's a video, for instance, they can have that video played again over and over again as many times as they want. What normally happens, because the electronic equipment is not in the jury room, they bring the jury out to the court, and then the attorneys are present while the jury watches whatever they're going to watch. And that's what happened today. And I believe the argument was that, well, wait a second, where'd this video come from, or at least a piece of it? Because apparently, according to the defense, they were thrown off guard and had not seen it. And that, if that's true, would be another egregious violation by the prosecution in this case, who I think has just committed violation upon violation and has politicized this case. And it's terrible to see. For due process on both sides of the aisle.
Now, what sort of is being said is it's not a new video in a technical sense. It's a new video in a technical sense, but not necessarily beyond that. That they're basically saying the video that was originally used was a scaled-down version because there was some, you know, went from Android to iPhone, something ended up happening. But clearly, they had a higher-end quality video. Why would that not be used to begin with?
Well, so there's two parts to this. One, the prosecution doesn't have to use it, but what they have to do is turn it over to the defense in what's called discovery, because that contains information that could be exculpatory or evidence of innocence for the defense. And that's the number one area where a prosecutor and a case can get in trouble, is if you intentionally withhold evidence. And if that's the case here, what they're basically saying is, hey, we showed a 7-minute tape during trial, and I'm just making up these numbers.
Yeah.
But in the video they showed the jury was 7 minutes and 29 seconds long. Well, what the heck happened in the 29 seconds, and why wasn't it given to the defense so they could prepare adequately for the trial? And also, you're supposed to receive that information before trial in the case you want to recommend to your client that he take a plea. There's so many ways that that can go, and that's such the critical importance of discovery and following your obligations under the Constitution, which I don't know that this prosecution has followed many, if any, of it. And I think Kyle Rittenhouse has a lot of good standing, hopefully, after an acquittal, to do some defamation cases like we're doing at fightwithcash.com.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, again, when you have a higher quality video where you can better see Rittenhouse, again, being the victim of an aggressor, that obviously goes to what happened that night. And it's remarkable here. How much does the jury know about what's going on here?
Well, that's the other tricky part. So what generally happens is, even though there's some errors, there can be some even egregious errors, what the judges normally do is they send the jury out, because they don't want to taint the jury with the arguments from either side until there's a ruling and an instruction by the judge. And that's the correct way to do it. So the jury's also probably left going, what's going on?
Yeah.
Because they're not lawyers. They don't know the process. So they're back there just ruminating and trying to decide this young man's guilt or innocence. But at the same time, it's a egregious constitutional violation, if true, against Kyle Rittenhouse, because now you have a jury who's deliberating over his faith, who possibly may not have even gotten all of the evidence because the prosecution didn't give it to the defense in the first place.
Exactly. So take us through, then, if you could, what comes next? The judge hinted at, I guess, some sort of evidence hearing.
That's a likely start. An evidentiary hearing is usually granted to determine whether or not the prosecution should be held in contempt and or if he committed errors, if he just made a mistake. And look, sometimes there's like, honestly, look, I did a lot of computer cases, and it's, that stuff gets complicated, transferring A to B and whatever. Sometimes literally just a mistake. But in this instance, with so many violations that have been alleged, and with this prosecutor's outrageous conduct, it's looking less and less like a mistake and more like an intentional act, which is a violation in law, and he can be brought up in contempt charges. Now, that's just for the prosecutor. What that does for the case is something entirely different. The defense has requested a mistrial, which is basically saying the error is so harmful that this case has to be declared a mistrial, and they've asked for it to be with prejudice. What that means is they're saying you can never file this case again, Judge, if you grant this mistrial. It's the most egregious error that can be remedied by this solution.
But that's the second time, right? That's the second time that a motion to dismiss with prejudice has been introduced.
Yeah, and we shouldn't focus on the number of times it's introduced because, look, most defense attorneys ask for a mistrial.
All the day, yeah, that part.
Cases. But it's the substance that's the problem,
exactly.
Right? And that's concerning to me, and that's why I think this young man has not, from my understanding, been given a fair trial. And I've been speaking out about, you know, people who have been, and look, we'll get to his defamation stuff soon thereafter, but this is the problem. Because of misinformation and possibly intentional fraud here, this young man's career, like the Covington kid, has been sort of destroyed. And that's why you have to have defamation lawsuits, and that's why I started fightwithcash.com with K. And I encourage your audience to check out the website and help us out where we can. We're filing lawsuits and paying for them for any American who's been defamed and has a case. We're raising money so we can pay for their lawyers so they can clear their name.
Yeah, especially because cases like that are not always easy to win and actually can be really expensive. That's why, again, go to fightwithcash.com. Yeah. It's spelled cash with a K, fightwithcash, K-A-S-H.com. We've been talking with Kash Patel. He's the former chief of staff for the Secretary of Defense under President Donald Trump. Thank you so much for stopping by and giving us a little bit of a better understanding of what's going to happen. Just very quickly, 20 seconds, what do you think comes of what the jury is asking for and what the defense motions have been?
I think the jury's probably going to come back with what we call a mixed bag of a verdict, a couple of misdemeanor counts, and I think ultimately the judge is going to rule in favor of the defense on this motion of mistrial. He can always do that after the verdict is reached. He doesn't have to do it before.
Yeah, and perfect world, you just go ahead and come out. Jury says, no, he's clear on everything, and then the judge doesn't have to get involved because that's going to create a whole new bit of controversy from people who don't quite understand how this works and have already been going after the judge. Again, fightwithcash.com, cash with a K. Kash Patel, my friend. Thank you so much for stopping by. Really appreciate it.
Look forward to seeing you soon. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Jason Rance Show. Got another hour coming up right after this on AM 770 KTTH.